Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics detective who has crusaded heroically against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic, and he is also the editor of the From the Wilderness newsletter. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, it's a pleasure, and we always seem to make it somehow in spite of obstacles, don't we?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Let's hope that the society as a whole can continue to do that. I'm less than completely optimistic, but on the other hand, with the kind of work that you're doing and with the kind of work that your co-editor, Catherine Austin Fitz, is doing, and I want to devote some time to some of what she's had to say. Who knows? Maybe there's hope even yet. And by the way, I also want to apologize to listeners. If I sound a little bit different, it's because I have a little bit of laryngitis, so the CIA hasn't cloned Dave Emery and substituted him in my place. So don't worry if I sound a little different. It's just I'm a little bit hoarse. So that's the way it goes. Anyway, Mike, there's a great deal to discuss. I haven't even had a chance to digest all of the material in your two successive articles on the Dominican connection. We can talk about that a little later, perhaps, although I like to have that all down in a row before I discuss it. But you've been covering a number of stories, and I understand that there's still more in the pipeline about the George W. story, but you're not in a position to talk about that. Tell us what you can at this point, if you would.
Well, there are additional leads on the George W. Drug story, which broke in my newsletter in the July issue, and, of course, which put me on the radio circuit all over the country. I am absolutely convinced that there's a lot of smoke, and there's duck tracks and duck feathers and duck manure, so there's probably something going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of intrigue, and as you can probably imagine, with something as intense as a presidential campaign.
Perhaps this is the quack cocaine epidemic.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead.
At stake, though, that was very good. That there's a lot of intrigue and there's a lot of pressure being put on witnesses and informants, and some of those circumstances are changing in terms of things people say or represented. However, when you leave all of that aside, there still is remaining a hard thread of evidence indicating that George W. Bush was definitely involved in something connected to the DEA and several kilos of cocaine in Florida in 1985, and I'll be reporting on that more soon. We have some tail numbers we're going to check out of aircraft that may be connected to this, and we have some other leads, which I'm not prepared to comment on at the moment. But let me just reassure you and the listeners, this story is very much alive.
I also want to fill the listeners in on the fact that you have, counting syndication, been speaking about this on some 150 radio stations around the country. And I want to commend you for not only your dedication, but your courage and selflessness, because I don't think, I may be wrong, but I don't think you're going to get a medal from the Bush family for doing that.
Probably not. And actually, we've topped 700. We had a couple of major networks. I don't know if it's okay to mention the networks or not, but
sure.
One was Westwood One, which was 300 stations at one shot.
Wow.
So we did. We've hit more than 700 stations in the last month with the story. And what's amazing is that I'm not taking a lot of shots right now. I've been very thorough about documenting my work and mailing copies of my notes and being accurate as far as reporting goes. But there's something here. It's just going to take some time to dig it out, I think.
Right, and at the risk of seeming maybe a trifle fatuous, I would like to recommend you as an example to the listening audience, because ultimately, if anything's going to get done positive, some people are going to have to stick their necks out, and the exemplary courage that you've demonstrated in taking this very sensitive story at a very, very critical time, I think, well, it's exemplary, and I think people ought to follow your example.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate that, but I was one of those guys who was always too stupid to duck anyway, and because I've been at this for 21 years, and insofar as exposing the agency's role and the corruption in government behind the whole drug trade, but it's something that needs to get done, and I don't know how you feel or how your listeners feel, but I sense some great changes taking place across the political landscape in terms of what's happening with the people. I see the government starting to crack in many places, vis-a-vis Waco and many other stories where the lies of the government are really starting to stand bare naked and not stand the light of day. And I see people having an impact, and so I'm out here trying to fan those flames because I don't want to do it alone.
They're probably the wrong metaphor to use in the context of having just spoken about Waco,
no,
but we'll proceed. Now, speaking, actually, continuing a bit with the metaphor, with the idea of ruined houses and raised dwellings, let's move to a fascinating bit of research that we touched on in our last interview. But that I would like to go into in more detail, and that is some of the work that has been accessed in from the wilderness by your now assistant editor. Is it assistant or co-editor, Catherine Austin Fitz?
She's contributing editor.
Contributing editor, right. Catherine Austin Fitz. Tell us briefly about her background before we get into some of the really scary things that she's had to reveal.
She's an amazing lady. She has an MBA from the Wharton School of Business. She rose through sheer hard work, perseverance, and a very uncanny and intuitive style to become a managing director of the Wall Street investment bank Dillon Reed under Nicholas Brady, who became George Bush's Secretary of the Treasury. She went to Washington in 1989 as Assistant Secretary of Housing under Jack Kemp and was very innovative and promptly got fired for being a pretty straight ethical and not going along with a lot of the political agendas in the Bush administration. But she remained very active as an investment banker and became a consultant for HUD again under Henry Cisneros. And, of course, that didn't end well for Cisneros. But she had some absolutely amazing ideas. She was born and raised in Philadelphia in an inner-city neighborhood with a lot of black neighbors. And she has some great ideas about generating wealth from the bottom up instead of the top down and how it can actually be more profitable to do that. But she had some really penetrating insights on how the money worked and some aggressive styles that were saving taxpayers billions of dollars in the 90s through contracts she and her company Hamilton and Securities had for HUD. But she also started making maps and teaching people in the inner cities how to understand how the money worked, and especially after she had made a map which kind of revealed CIA-connected ethnic cleansing in Los Angeles connected to the Gary Webb stories in 96, she was systematically, ruthlessly attacked by the government to put her out of business. And she's still suffering from that today, even though no charges have been filed anywhere, and after 3.5 years and losing $2 million personally and her company $100 million, she's being vindicated on all fronts that she never did anything wrong. But she's a very brave lady who is, like me, absolutely convinced that we have reached a stage of corruption in the current government which is not sustainable. It has to collapse or change in the very near future.
By the way, although it might be putting the cart before the horse to a certain extent, we should bear in mind who Catherine Austin Fitz is. If you could, Mike, just briefly outline the harassment that Hamilton, her company, received. And also, I don't know if this is something that you or Catherine would feel comfortable about having on the air, but you mentioned some of the extracurricular types of harassment that the powers that be can administer, talking about electromagnetically to people. And this by way of understanding not only what Catherine Austin Fitz has to say, and we're going to get into some of her discoveries when you and she hooked up and she combined her knowledge about federally subsidized housing and inner city economics with your knowledge about narcotics and where the intelligence community has diverted some of the drugs to, or directed, I should say, would be a better word. If you could just tell her, again, this is sort of cart before the horse, but tell us a little bit about what happened to Hamilton and some of what Catherine herself has been subjected to as a result of what we're then going to talk about.
Well, in 1996, Catherine was had designed, really, a program in the Edgewood community, which was a HUD Section 8 subsidized housing project in Washington, D.C., basically unemployed black single mothers, most of whom did not even have high school. And Catherine Austin Fitz said, I'll just call her Fitz to make it shorter. Fitz said basically, look, why is Citibank paying tens of millions of dollars to ship our data overseas to Korea to be processed when we have people on welfare who could process our data right here in the HUD projects, which would take them off welfare and pay them money? She was real innovative along those lines, and she set up computer learning centers inside HUD housing projects, and she used HUD data to teach the women who worked there how to process data, not only for HUD, but for many of its contracts. And she started making maps, and one of the maps that she made in 96 was a map of single-family mortgage defaults in Los Angeles in the, roughly in the period from 1982 through 1990, which was the crack cocaine epidemic. And lo and behold, that map was a perfect match with the drug dealing territory of Freeway Ricky Ross, who was the CIA drug dealer. And somebody had bought all of those homes for 10, 20 cents on the dollar after middle-class wage-earning families, black families, had fled because they couldn't keep up the payments on homes that were no longer worth anything. Catherine was also really trying to empower people in inner cities, because she views HUD and the government and all of the related law enforcement efforts as really destructive. When I say destructive, I mean destructive of wealth. And so she was teaching the people there how to generate wealth, but also how to understand how their own money and their government worked. And it was said to her at one point, and we will see this quote coming up in the next issue of From the Wilderness in September, that people in Washington actually called this, and this is now, I'm quoting a government official saying this was about computers for niggers, close quote, which was, of course, utterly offensive. But as Catherine proceeded with that and started to make connections with massive gentrification programs connected to Wall Street investment, connected back to heavy areas of CIA-influenced drug trafficking, Catherine became a major threat. All of a sudden, stories were planted all throughout Washington. The HUD Inspector General, Susan Gaffney, went after Catherine, and stories were appearing in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post that she was being investigated for horrific crimes and so on and so forth. HUD canceled her contracts and impounded her money. They audited her. And it was a horrible campaign of rumors, which began in 1996, and to this day, not a single complaint, either civil or criminal, has been filed against Catherine.
We should note that rumor mongering is one of the powers that be's special elements, special tools of the trade. There are all kinds of high-tech and very sophisticated things, but good old-fashioned rumor mongering should not be underestimated. It can do a lot of damage.
That's and hers is a classic case of how that worked. Now, recently, especially since Catherine's been working with me and with information I've been able to provide her on covert operations, the Justice Department has completely closed out any criminal allegations against her and said she's clean as a Safeway chicken. And she's in the process now, it looks like, of having all the civil charges finally come to an end. But again, much of the damage has been done, but within the last year or so, especially as Catherine has made some CIA connections and gone public in many ways that would hurt the Bush family and the CIA especially, but it would hurt the Clintons as well. She and her staff have been subjected to various non-lethal weapons, including what appear to be electromagnetic pulse weapons and microwave weapons, all of which exist, by the way. These are very well documented, and they're in the government inventory.
Sure, and by the way, this audience has also heard at considerable length and for many years about some of those weaponry. So this about that type of weaponry. So this is something they are familiar with.
Well, this was witnessed by a number of people who were working for Catherine, where she was living at a house in Washington, D.C. She's since moved out. Extremely well documented. And what's interesting about HUD, and very few people know this, is that HUD has its own police policing powers. It has a thing called Operation Safe Streets, where it can literally drop a SWAT team and declare martial law anywhere within, I believe it's something like 2 miles of any HUD mortgage, and that includes single-family mortgages.
No
Fannie
kidding.
And Freddie Mac.
No kidding.
And suspend the Constitution and just do these massive search and destroy missions, and HUD has all of these huge powers, which are connected in several ways to a Department of Justice program called Weed and Seed, which also involves suspension of certain portions of the Constitution. And it's very questionable whether it's legal or not. But HUD is very nasty, and if you just look at the way HUD is operating from a de facto basis, and Catherine's second part of her series will be coming up, like I say, in the September issue, which mails end of next week. Basically, that HUD can be described de facto as a farm system for people to put in prison so that the companies that make money off of the prison, drug war, law enforcement economy will always have plenty of bodies to put in jail.
Let's jump, Mike, if we could, in the discussion, because the macroeconomics and macro politics of this situation are truly horrifying and fascistic, and they don't smack of genocide, but actually are sort of a clandestine form of slow-motion genocide, and maybe slow-motion isn't even the right term. This past summer, you were in Washington, D.C., and that's how you made contact with Catherine Austin Fitz. And one of the things that, I guess, sort of ignited not only your professional relationship, but also got the wheels turning for her, was when you made her aware of some of the areas in Los Angeles that had been primarily affected by the crack cocaine epidemic, as revealed by the Gary Webb series that ran in the Mercury News a few years ago, and also Gary Webb's own book, Dark Alliance, which develops that still further. When looking at the cocaine empire of Freeway Ricky Ross, and we should bear in mind his nickname, that made a number of connections for Catherine about some of the HUD territories in Los Angeles. And if you could develop for us, we've talked about this briefly, but if you could develop for us what exactly she found and what the real significance was of that, bearing in mind who Catherine Austin Fitz is.
Yeah, well, she, of course, had been the Assistant Secretary of Housing, so she was the FHA commissioner. And as an Assistant Secretary, she was cabinet level and had been confirmed by the Senate, and so she was up there. She was an extremely successful Wall Street banker. And she had been trying to figure out why in 1996. By the way, the Gary Webb stories appeared in August, which was just 2 months or 2.5 months before the presidential election of 96. And again, I see no coincidence there. I mean, that I believe was intended. But she had been looking for explanations as to why all of a sudden she became so dangerous. Now, she had been roughly aware of a program called, or a concept called gentrification,
mm-hmm.
wherein inner city land was systematically or routinely trashed, abandoned, and so-called land banked, where it could be saved and put aside for some kind of redevelopment at a future date. She didn't really grasp. Now, she made this map of Los Angeles using the computers with the black women at Edgewood in Washington, D.C., but she made this map of Los Angeles and showed it at a housing conference in Boston in August of 96, exactly 2 weeks before the Gary Webb stories broke. Again, she didn't read the Gary Webb stories at the time. She was ignorant. She didn't grasp the significance of what she had revealed until roughly 1998. That was before she met me. She and I met actually in March of this year. But when she read Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, there was a line in there where Ricky Ross is saying, what do I do with all this money? I can't hide it under the bed anymore, and I can't keep putting it in the bank. And Danilo Blondon, the CIA-friendly drug dealer agent, you know, said to him, do what everybody else does, man. Put it in real estate. And Catherine all of a sudden had this huge light bulb go on, and she pulled out the map and realized that the map that she had of defaulted single-family home loans, unsold, was a perfect match with Ricky Ross's drug dealing activities as engineered and protected by and supplied by the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, after she met me, I, being a former LAPD narcotics investigator and someone who knows Los Angeles very well, having lived here since 67, looked at this map, and it was more than an epiphany for me, because the map was so perfect that there's this one little particular finger of land in the west side of south central Los Angeles running near La Cienega and the border with Culver City that was a particular gang area that was particularly intransigent, and the dots of the defaulted home loans exactly match this little tiny sliver of land. I mean, that's how close the correlation was. And I just said, oh, my God. And she said, oh, my God. And what we realized was that from the period between 1982 and 1990, as the crack cocaine epidemic raged throughout Los Angeles, middle-class black wage-earning families who had mortgages on homes that were $100,000, $150,000 suddenly found their homes worth maybe $60,000, $70,000, They couldn't sell them. Their kids were getting arrested. The neighborhood was deteriorating. It wasn't safe to live there. They couldn't sell. Eventually, many of the businesses which employed them closed. And so what did they do? They walked away. And their credit, of course, was ruined, probably for life. And those homes sat fallow. But somebody else came along years later and bought those same houses for 10, 20, 30 cents on the dollar. And much
of that sounds, by the way, not unlike the way the economics of the SNL scandal worked out.
Absolutely. And much of that land now in South Central Los Angeles happens to be very close to a project being proposed by a group including Michael Ovitz and Disney to completely rebuild the Coliseum and all of the surrounding areas. So that same property, all of a sudden, and much else of it is right along the Alameda Corridor, which is a new transportation commercial corridor. So now it's all going way back up in value. And so we see a pattern, and guess what? We find, and we will be disclosing this in future issues of From the Wilderness. We're going to be doing a long series of articles on this. The gentrification methodology was used, and I have NYPD officers telling me about it, in the 1970s in Washington Heights in New York City, where CIA was deliberately targeting certain areas, and major political figures connected to David Dinkins in New York City were systematically trashing certain neighborhoods to drive the real estate prices down so they could buy it dirt cheap and then clean it up again and gentrify it and have the upper middle class move back in.
And the situation in New York City right now is horrendous with Rudy Giuliani. I mean, it's virtually under martial law. I mention this because Giuliani himself, as a U.S. attorney, was, shall we say, less than vigorous in pursuing one of the major Iran-Contra cases with Ari Ben-Benash and a number of people. That's where I first noticed Giuliani, because he was, shall we say, he exercised extreme judicial restraint when going after the Iran-Contra crew. But judicial restraint is a term that's unknown in New York City these days, particularly as regards minorities.
Yeah, and I think there's a whole new set of circumstances happening around New York right now. One of the interesting points that Catherine makes, and actually I make as well, is this little short story that I'm about to tell you says volumes.
Okay, by the way, Mike, we have about three or four minutes on this side, so at a good stopping place, then we'll turn over and we'll continue it on the other side of this tape.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The four largest states, David, what would you say for the importation of drugs?
Four largest states?
Mm-hmm.
All right, New York, California, Texas, and Florida.
Bingo. What are, now, the U.S. Justice Department acknowledges that probably $200 billion a year in drug money is laundered in the U.S. Which four states launder most of that drug money?
Well, let me take a guess. Those four states. New York, California, Texas, and Florida.
Bingo.
The last two, of course, headed up by what I call the Sons of Bushes.
That's right.
Yep.
Now, which four states supply 80% of all presidential campaign funds?
Well, let me consult the Psychic Friends Network. I think. Oh, let's see. I see a C. That's California.
Yes.
I see an N. That's New York. A T. Texas. And oh, I'm almost got the last one. F. Oh, that's Florida.
You win the prize.
Uh-huh.
So, if the Bushes govern Texas and Florida, you can understand why New York is so important to Hillary Clinton and the Clinton faction. So, what's going on, of course, is New York is hugely important, and I have written a series of stories recently on the Dominican connection to the CIA, where CIA documents turned up and were just amazing, directly linking Dominican drug gangs to the Colombian drug cartels, and we're getting ready to go to war there, so that the Dominicans now controlling the eastern seaboard are directly contributing to Democratic political campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
So basically now what's going on is we have, the U.S. has become Colombia. And now that Colombia has become the single largest drug-producing nation in the world, we're getting ready to go to war there because forget everything you hear about Colombia. When the president of the New York Stock Exchange has to make a cold call on the FARC guerrillas to ask them to put their drug money back in the stock exchange, you know something's wrong.
Yep, I guess if we've become the new Colombia, then that adds a whole new level of meaning to Colombia, the gem of the ocean. We're just a different spelling, but the same word will apply. You know what, Mike, on this side, since we're running near the end of the side, if you would give, because some of the radio stations that air this only air a half hour, if you would give the particulars about how people can get in touch with you, both in terms of speaking engagements and in terms of the From the Wilderness newsletter.
You can reach me, email at mrupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T, at copvcia.com. You can go to my website and find all the information on how to subscribe to From the Wilderness. Again, that's www.copvcia.com. You can call during normal business hours, 818-788-8791, or you can write to me at Post Office Box 6061-350 in Sherman Oaks, California, 91413.
And your website?
www.copvcia.com.
One word. Yep, that's copvcia.com. And email, again?
M. Rupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T, at copvcia.com.
And also note that there are a number of other interviews with Mike Rupert, including interviews with regard to the Tyree case and a very stimulating interview with D. Caron Ferdinand. They're available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email spitfire at ix.netcom.com. And the Spitfire website, equipped, by the way, with real audio, so you can hear the tapes going out to the stations, spitfirelist.com. That's one word, and again, I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. No money from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. We're going to be continuing our fascinating discussion with Mike Rupert on the other side of this tape. For Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.